Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 27th of February, these are our main stories. Brazil is one of several new countries to report its first case, but the WHO says the COVID-19 coronavirus is not yet a pandemic. Zambia's 95-year-old former president makes a rare intervention on a crisis that's gripped the nation. And the former world number one in women's tennis, Maria Sharapova, has announced her retirement from the sport. Also in this podcast, the man who raised the Titanic, at least in fiction, has passed away.
I used to stop and ask myself, what would the reader like to see? And I'd try and give it to him. And of course, there's a multitude of subplots. I literally threw in everything but the kitchen sink.
Now, we could fill this podcast by simply telling you about how countries around the world are responding to the COVID-19 coronavirus. For the first time, there have been more new cases outside China than inside, and while the authorities in Beijing insist they're seeing a steady fall in the number of deaths and infections, elsewhere, more and more countries are reporting their first cases. And for those directly affected, daily life has become a bit more complicated. Leila Biso is a pharmacist in the small town of Castel Pusterlengo at the heart of the outbreak in northern Italy.
We are locked down. There's a red zone. We are inside the red zone. We cannot leave the red zone. Schools are closed. All the factories and commercial activities are closed. The only stores open are pharmacies. So I'm working. And supermarkets. It's hard, the feeling of not being able to move around. But we stay positive and enjoy being in the house with the kids. And when I'm off work, we go to my parents-in-law and we enjoy being in the garden.
Brazil, meanwhile, has registered Latin America's first known instance of the virus. Our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Camila Mota, has more.
So the first case of coronavirus confirmed in Brazil is of a 61-year-old man who was on a duty trip to Italy for the past 10 days. He came back, developed a few of the symptoms, went to the hospital. They ran a first test, which came out positive. Then they ran what they call a counterproof, which also, according to sources of the record, came out positive. Brazilians are worried because we just held our yearly carnival for the past 4 days. So lots of people in the streets, lots of crowds. So people are worried that that might have helped to spread the virus in the country. Brazil has been preparing for this for the past 2 months. Congress passed a piece of legislation earlier in February, which allows the government to take a lot of measures to contain the spread of the virus. In the case of an outbreak, they can, for example, put people in quarantine, isolate people, run tests compulsory. The state of São Paulo, where the first case has been confirmed, is putting up a contingency committee to help to contain the spread of the virus.
Camila Mota in Sao Paulo. So how is the international response to the coronavirus crisis progressing? A question for our health correspondent, Sophie Hutchinson.
Containment is still ongoing, and some countries have been extremely successful at that, particularly in the European area. So far, things have been good, but we're now seeing problems in Italy. And obviously, in northern Italy, there are 11 areas now with, you know, these outbreaks where whole communities are having to be quarantined. In terms of the outbreak as a whole, most of the cases, more than 78,000, are in China. But we're now seeing more new cases outside of China than we are within China. It's only just reached that tipping point, but it's just that globally it's now taking off in other parts of the world.
And what the WHO is saying with it taking off in other parts of the world is that countries need to prepare themselves. Are they preparing themselves? And if so, how?
So obviously different countries are doing different things. Some countries are extremely well prepared. Other countries where there are less well-developed health systems and where primary care is not so good, there are real concerns about what will happen if infections get into those areas. So, for example, in Iran, there hasn't been any quarantine, and there's real concern among scientists about what that now looks like in Iran and what the real numbers are in terms of infection rates.
Are we learning any more about the disease itself and how it behaves?
Well, scientists are studying it the whole time, trying to see what works against it. They're trying all sorts of avenues in terms of a vaccine. So they're trying anti-malarials, they're trying antiretrovirals, they're trying antibodies from people who have recovered from the virus. But we still know really very little about it. There is this 14-day period when people are meant to go and self-isolate if they've been possibly exposed to the disease. But scientists still don't know the exact period when a person might be infectious. They just think that the 14 days is a really broad number so that people will be safe when they come out if they haven't been infected.
Sophie Hutchinson. Delhi remains on edge after the worst violence the Indian capital has seen in decades. 27 people have been killed during three nights of rioting between Hindus and Muslims over the controversial new citizenship law. Critics say the law discriminates against Muslims. Yogita Limaye reports from Delhi.
A stream of Muslim families leaving the Hindu-dominated areas they live in. Men, women and children carrying bags, hurrying to safety. Hindu mobs are slaughtering us like goats and chickens, said one of those fleeing. Two mosques in the neighbourhood were set on fire. Inside, holy books have been reduced to ashes. Just outside the gate, a Muslim man was stabbed to death. His daughters, too young to understand why their mother is so inconsolable. I want to tell the government to protect everyone. Don't allow our homes to be destroyed and our children to be orphaned, she says. Muslims have accused the police of turning a blind eye to Hindu mobs armed with sticks, stones and even guns. But Hindus say they were targeted by Muslims. They were throwing petrol bombs at our homes. We barely managed to escape, one Hindu woman said. More police have been deployed on the ground now, but many are asking why it wasn't done when the violence was at its worst.
Yogita Limaye. If you've never seen a red panda, please fire up the internet and do an image search right now. I mean, now. I know, right? So cute. Red pandas live in the mountainous forests of China, the Himalayas, Nepal, Bhutan and Myanmar. And scientists have just discovered that they are actually two species of this endangered animal. As our science correspondent Helen Briggs told me, this information makes conservation even more critical.
They look slightly different. So there's the Chinese red panda and the Himalayan red panda. And if you know what you're looking for, the Chinese ones have redder fur and more striped tail rings, while the Himalayan ones have whiter faces. But until now, they were thought to be just different populations, just different subspecies, if you like, because we haven't really had the genetic evidence. But a research team in China was able to get samples and do DNA tests. And on the basis of that, they're considered now two completely separate species. Now, for some, that's a technicality, it's a sort of semantic interest. But the really important thing is about conservation, because numbers are already down to a few thousand in the wild.
Why are they endangered?
Well, they used to be hunted and they're still illegally hunted. One scientist told me that they're still hunted in parts of China, especially for their highly valued bushy tail, which is made to produce hats, good luck charm hats used by newlyweds. And they have a very specialised habitat. They've got this very thick hair. They're adapted to living up in the mountains in bamboo forests. They've got these claws that they use to cling onto the bamboos. So they're very specialised. But these habitats are shrinking because of development, also because of climate change. So there's just less habitat for them. So they are really important species to save because they're in a family of their own. They're one of the most evolutionary distinct mammals in the world. You know, we haven't got any more of that type of animal. They were thought thought to be related to raccoons and then to bears, but now we know they're in a complete class of their own.
So they're not like the giant panda then?
They're not related to the giant panda. As I say, they're in their own genus, which makes them very precious, which means scientists are fighting very hard to save them.
And what are the scientists doing, and how will this new information change their approach?
Well, first of all, they've been red-listed as endangered, which means they're on the brink of extinction. That's on the basis of this one population. But we now know that there are actually two species, and it means that one, the Himalayan red panda, needs more urgent protection because it's got lower genetic diversity and a smaller population size. So it may mean that they may relist them in even more urgent status, and it also has implications for zoos because these red pandas are found in zoos, and it means that you have to be very careful, keep the two species separate, not interbreed, to maintain this genetic preciousness, if you like.
Helen Briggs. Now, from the red panda to a red fruit, the tomato, and in East Africa, a shortage has led to a hike in prices. The reason? Heavy rains that hit the region at the end of last year. And as Mercy Juma reports, if conditions for farmers don't improve, customers will continue to face rising prices for an essential part of their favourite dishes.
I am walking through a very expansive tomato farm. Thousands of tomato trees are planted here, but almost every single tree has pale green leaves with purplish black lesions. The fruits on the trees have turned black and are rotting. These are wrinkled, their color has changed from bright red to dark brown, and they do have a terrible smell. Spreading from one crop to the next and one farm to the other, the tomato blight, a fungal disease made worse by rainy weather, is the cause of this devastation.
You know, this thing happens in one night. It is not progressive.
Isaac Kamau is a large-scale tomato farmer in Laikipia in Kenya's Rift Valley. His farm spreads as far as my eyes can see.
It's very devastating because we usually monitor these farms every day. You know, this is my business. So I wake up in the morning and go and check if everything is fine. If it's not fine, then what am I supposed to do? So I woke up one morning, go to the farm, and bang, about 70% of the crop is done. I've put my investment there. I was almost going to the market. So you can imagine losing all of that in one night.
Laikipia is the center of tomato farming in the country. Unexpected rains towards the end of last year, which have continued into February, have seen very little of the fruit make it out to the market. Thousands of kilograms of tomatoes lie in waste and fit for consumption.
About 30% of the crop that was left is going to the market. I've sold it. It's a very high price. The majority of farmers are not happy at all because they're having to sell.
The economic repercussions are already playing out in major cities like Nairobi and Mombasa. A few weeks ago, one tomato was about 5 US cents in Nairobi. Today, that same tomato sells for about 25 to 35 US cents. Uganda and Tanzania have also been affected by the blight. Last year, most of East Africa experienced one of the wettest short rains season on record. Rainfall totals were four times higher than average. Experts say this contributed to low harvests and substandard quality of tomatoes and other produce. Linda Ogalu is a climate change specialist.
We've seen global warming being manifested in different ways. For example, the oceans are warming. We've seen the temperatures are rising. 2019, for example, was the second hottest year on record, according to WMO. Warming of the Indian Ocean during the OND 2019 led to us having one of the wettest years in the region. Fungal diseases become more and more prevalent, and therefore plants that do not like water, like tomatoes, end up being a casualty.
Crop rotation, proper fungicide use, as well as the removal of all plant remains at the end of the growing season are some of the key measures to help keep tomato blight at bay. So far, uninfected farmers in the region have decided to plant tomatoes and risk a bad harvest. Meanwhile, the Kenya Meteorological Department is predicting yet more rainfall at above average rates over the next few months. If this does happen, cooking with tomatoes will become a luxury for many people in East Africa.
Mercy Juma reporting. Still to come in this podcast, we found a way to stop seagulls stealing your food. The only problem is, you can't eat it either. It's a story involving witchcraft, fear, and even lynchings. For months now, Zambia has been transfixed by a spate of killings that have cost at least 50 people their lives. The situation is now so serious that the country's founding father, 95-year-old former President Kenneth Kaunda, has felt the need to intervene. I heard more from our Africa editor, Mary Harper.
It's very mysterious. Since December, people have been gassed in their schools, in their homes, even in prisons. People have been gassed by a mysterious chemical which renders them unconscious. And this has caused panic in the country. And what's happened now is that basically the population have taken the law into their own hands and they've started attacking people, killing people who they suspect of being behind these mysterious gas attacks. And this number has now risen to 50. So it's a huge number of people who've been killed. We don't know whether they had anything to do with the gas attacks or not. But there is kind of mass panic, and this is being fueled by social media, which has just got the most extraordinary tales of what happens to people once they're gassed, who's behind it and everything.
Yes, and in a situation where at the very foundation there is mystery and many unknown facts, how easy is it to separate myth from reality?
It's basically impossible. Nobody knows what kind of chemical this is, but even just yesterday, a primary school in the capital, Lusaka, was gassed, and people do become unconscious when this happens. Then there's all sorts of stories abounding about what happens to people once they're rendered unconscious, and there's stories that they are robbed. There's also these very strange stories about how syringes are produced by the perpetrators. They withdraw blood from these people and then they use the blood for ritual purposes, for traditional medicine. They've also been arrests. About 25 people have been arrested by the police who are blamed for being behind these attacks, but we still don't really know anything more about this, which I suppose is adding to the state of anxiety and panic in the country. There was one old woman who was quoted today saying, "We can't even sleep at night because we're so afraid." And because these attacks are also taking place in people's homes, it is really, really making the situation untenable.
And what does it tell us that a 95-year-old former president has got involved?
Well, this, the first president of independent Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda, like an old, respected African statesman, he's not heard of very much these days, but he's come out calling, number one, for an end to these mysterious chemical attacks and also pleading with the population to please stop attacking people they suspect of being perpetrators and actually killing them, lynching them. So it really shows that things have got pretty desperate. I mean, we already had the First Lady, when she was pleading with people to stop doing this, she collapsed, she burst into tears, fell to the floor, had to be helped up. And it just shows how worried the authorities are. And also the army has been deployed to try to deal with this situation, but the attacks are continuing.
Mary Harper. One of the best-known names in women's tennis says she's quitting the sport at the age of 32. Maria Sharapova won 5 Grand Slam tournaments in the course of her career. 4 years ago, she was banned for 15 months after testing positive for using a banned performance-enhancing drug, Meldonium. Jo Drury is a British tennis coach and commentator and a former top 10 player herself. She told Tim Franks how big a figure Maria Sharapova has been.
Well, to win 5 Grand Slams, to be the sort of highest earner off court as well for 11 years, even higher than Serena Williams at times. Just what she's achieved with her determination, her work rate, her absolute world-class attitude, and also that she won all 4 Grand Slams, you know, so that's every surface. And for me, probably the biggest achievement was winning Roland Garros, which she did twice on a court, a clay court, very slow. She didn't move particularly well on it, but she was sort of determined to overcome that and learnt how to play on it through her own determination.
And it was a sensational start, wasn't it, that she won Wimbledon just at the age of 17?
Yes, that's right. I mean, that was such a shock to beat Serena then, and she just played so well. She really took it to Serena. I mean, her serve, the way she hit her ground shots on that day, I don't think Serena could quite believe it. I don't think any of us could, really.
She's retired at the age of 32, saying that, you know, her body is just not doing it for her anymore. Yeah. But she was banned back in 2016 for just over a year, testing positive for this substance, meldonium, which she said she hadn't realised that it was a banned substance. I mean, she never really sort of made it back to the heights, did she, after that?
I don't actually think it was the ban that has done it. I think she has been injured, actually, for a number of years. The shoulder has been a problem since about 2009. She had her first operation on her shoulder, and I think she'd been playing through pain, really, for the last 10 years. I know her arm as well was affected. You know, I think that the realisation has come that she just couldn't keep playing through the pain, and that was her decision today.
George Jury. One of America's most successful writers of thrillers has died. Clive Cussler wrote or co-wrote more than 80 books and had been published in more than 40 languages. He invested a lot of his earnings in the exploration of shipwrecks. This report from our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd.
Something's moving down there.
It was long before today's CGI, but the 1980 film version of Clive Cussler's early book, Raise the Titanic, made a good job of the climactic moment. But it had taken endless cash. Just the small-scale model of the Titanic cost $7 million, pretty much what the film took at the box office. Producer Lou Grade is reported to have said of Raise the Titanic, it would have been cheaper to lower the Atlantic. But Clive Cussler said the Titanic's story had given him exactly the start as a writer he'd needed.
It was a fun book to write because it was written for entertainment more than anything. I used to stop and ask myself, what would the reader like to see? And I'd try and give it to him. And of course, there's a multitude of subplots. I literally threw in everything but the kitchen sink.
Cussler was on the New York Times bestseller lists more than 20 times with stories which often featured the hero Dirk Pitt, later played in the film Sahara by Matthew McConaughey. Other books included Shockwave and Atlantis Found. Many feature the fictional US government organisation, the National Underwater and Marine Agency, or NUMA. Later, Clive Cussler, now a wealthy man, set up a real-life NUMA to conserve US marine heritage through the discovery and survey of shipwrecks. In the last 15 years of his prolific writing career, Clive Cussler co-wrote his stories with his son, also called Dirk.
Vincent Dowd. Many of us are trying to reduce the amount of single-use plastic we're throwing away, but until now, less attention has been paid to those single-use sachets of plastic, the ones with mayonnaise or soy sauce or shampoo. An estimated 855 billion of them are used and thrown away each year. Now a campaign group called A Plastic Planet has called for them to be outlawed. But just how feasible is that? Mark Miodovnik is a materials scientist at University College London and an expert in sustainable materials manufacturing.
Outlawing things on a global scale is probably not feasible, let's face it. But you could outlaw them country by country, for sure, yeah. But I think you've got to remember that how would you legally describe a sachet is not going to be easy, because in the UK, for instance, we come across sachets as in the context of condiments like mustard and ketchup. Other people in the world come across sachets probably more often as washing powder, where the context is very different. That is an economic necessity for them to be able to get them in those portions. And so outlawing it in that situation actually might do more harm than good.
So although we tend to think of sachets as being annoying and, in this case, environmentally degrading, actually for a lot of our listeners around the world, those who are in developing countries, they are actually very useful vehicles for delivering small bits of important household goods that they probably couldn't afford in larger quantities.
That's why I think just lumping the whole thing together as one topic is probably not the right way forward for this.
Okay. So you know, maybe to say that they should all be banned immediately, you could argue, is not desirable. However, are there ways in which we can reduce the amount of wastage?
Yes. For instance, let's say in the case of developed world, where you have companies like Deliveroo, what I've seen them do, which I think is a smart way to reduce the amount of sachets going out to customers, is to ask them to opt in on the app to ask if they want a sachet, and they, so you don't automatically get them thrown in the bag. So a lot of these are wasted just unnecessarily. People at home have those condiments, and if they don't necessarily need them or like them, they are not going to get them. So that's a systems change, which I think is a very smart one. The second one is you need to change the takeaway box itself so that it's a clamshell in one piece, so that you're not, bits of it are not separate, not little pots of anything. Indentations, and you squirt them in. Squirt the condiments in, so the whole thing is just one piece of plastic. And why do I say plastic? Why am I insisting on that? Because it is the best material for the job for these takeaway meals, in my view, in terms of carbon emissions and other waste. And for most of these countries, when we're talking about developed countries now, they have an infrastructure for recycling, and that will be recycled.
Material scientist Mark Miodovnik talking to Tim Franks. Now, listen to this. The sound of seagulls. If you've ever eaten on a beach, it won't surprise you to hear they watch us when we eat. What is more surprising is that they prefer our leftovers rather than untouched food. That's the conclusion of research carried out in the southwest of England by Madeline Gumas of Exeter University. She found out by heading to the seaside in sunglasses and carrying buckets of flapjacks that she pretended to eat.
My previous research that was out last year looked at whether herring gulls pay attention to where humans are looking. So I thought this time I should probably not be looking directly at them, not give them any other cues. So I put sunglasses on when I approached them. I had two flapjacks. I chose flapjacks because they're identical and I wanted to give gulls two identical food items to choose between. And I hid them under buckets so they couldn't see me holding them when I presented them, and then lifted away the buckets, picked up one of the flapjacks, handled it for 20 seconds and then put it back and moved away to allow the gull to approach. And I watched to see which one of the flapjacks the gull pecked at. In the majority of cases, so 19 out of the 24 gulls that would actually approach pecked at the handled one, which suggests that there is an effect of someone handling a food item. And it seems to act as a way of drawing their attention. I think perhaps they've learnt that people that have handled food, the packages have been opened and the food that is left inside is more accessible to them. I'm not saying that they only go for food that's been handled. It's just another thing they use to make decisions when they're foraging in these areas where there are lots of humans around. We know already that we shouldn't be dropping food and litter on the ground, and we should be putting it in a bin and somewhere safe, basically, that they can't get to it. But it's hard to make people actually think about it, and if they're not going to do that anyway, to do that. But it probably doesn't hurt to remind people that we are probably the reason that they made these associations and that they're hanging around us when we're eating outside.
Madeline Gumas. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.